Hey, everybody, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. My producer, as always, is Lou Pellegrino. Our guest this week is Mike Francesa, a huge name in sports talk radio. He is, of course, has been the dominant sports talk voice in the nation's biggest market, New York City, for four decades. Part of the arguably the most famous sports talk show in history, The Mike and the Mad Dog Show. And he will now leave his afternoon show on WFAN in New York on December 15th. We had a really interesting hour conversation that I think you're going to like. So coming up, Mike Francesa on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, and as promised, we bring in Mike Francesa, Mike from Long Beach. He has been, as I said at the top, the dominant sports voice in the nation's biggest market, New York City, for four decades. And he will leave his afternoon show on WFAN on December 15th, and he joins us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Mike, I want to start with this. Would you take the job of replacing you at WFAN?
Definitely. I think it's a great opportunity. Now, it's obviously a challenge. There are clearly big shoes to fill. We've been extremely successful starting with the Mad Dog and following up with myself. We've built something that's very, very powerful and is obviously a lot of ratings and revenue pressures. But, yeah, I think it's a great opportunity. I think it's the best job in the city. I think it's the number one piece of media real estate in the biggest city in the world. So, yes, I think it's a great opportunity that nobody could bypass. I know the old adage of don't follow a very successful person in, be the next person in. That's fine, but you don't know that you're going to get the job then. I would jump at it, absolutely.
Interesting. Why do you think? Why do you know that right now is the right time for you to end your tenure with WFAN?
You know, it really wasn't, when I first made the decision, it was kind of out of being upset at the company for some decisions they had made, which are long since passed. The people aren't even here anymore. We're not even in the same company anymore. So it really turned out to be perfect timing with all the different things that are happening now, CBS selling to Intercom, Intercom taking over just the last week or so. The way the industry has moved. So it started out, it just happened to be when my career was over and, when my contract was up. And at the time, I made it very clear to them that I was going to be out at the end of that contract. And to make sure that they understood that, I said it publicly with more than 30 months left on my contract, and everyone thought it was a joke. Well, you know, that time is 2 weeks away, and it's going to be the exact date that I said I would leave.
Mike, you're going to leave at the top of the ratings for the important demos for you. And I wonder, would you, if that was not the situation, if the show had slipped in terms of the ratings, would you be leaving if you were down in a ratings book? Or, I always think that one of the, I've read interviews with you where you said that was very important for you to leave at the top. So I wonder if you were not at the top, would you try to stick around to reclaim that?
Maybe. I mean, if I really had just fallen off recently, no, I've never fallen off, so it's never been an issue. I've never come close to losing to the competition. They've never even come close to beating me in any way. That's not been the case right now with a couple of weeks left in the rating book, and I'll be off the air before we get the final numbers, but we're first. We've been first the whole fall. It's pretty close between myself and one music station for first. Right now we're still up, but they've been narrowing the gap, which they do once we get towards Christmas music. But right now we're in first place. We can't finish worse than second. We're probably going to finish first, and that's very important to me to finish at the top. But I'll tell you this, Richard, if I had fallen dramatically, I would have left a long time ago. I wouldn't have been able to deal with that. I had set such a vocal standard about that, and I'd always laid claim to how important that was to me and to my persona. I wouldn't have been a person, and I don't blame anybody who does, who has had great success at the top and then still around 10 or 15 years later, and they're not a ratings factor anymore, but they're still working, God bless them. I couldn't personally be happy doing that. That's just not the way I'm built. I would have been very upset with that. So if I had tanked a long time ago, I would have been out a long time ago. But I never did, and that's why it was very important to maintain that standard. And, yes, very important that I go out as dominantly as I've been at any time in the last 30 years. And, you know, we were first 30 years ago, we were first 20 years ago, we were first 10 years ago, we're first now. So that means a lot to me, it does. Yeah.
Gosh, so I mean, it's not the perfect analogy, but you couldn't have done, let's say, what Jordan did, come back, play for the Wizards for a couple of years, knowing you're not going to win a championship, but you play for a little bit, you collect a big check.
You know, listen, roles change, so I understand that. You know, if I came back now and I did a radio part of it, if I come back in a couple of years and I contribute to a station and I understand my role has changed, I could understand that. But I wouldn't understand it where I was still expected to be hitting in the middle of the lineup, still be the guy who makes the most money, still be expected to drive the team and not be doing my job. That I couldn't do. If I came back at a different role and I understood it was a different role and I was comfortable with that role, that might be a different story. But being who I've been, to sit in the same show and watch it collapse, I couldn't have done that.
Mike, I remember how emotional you were the day Chris Russo called in when your show with him was dissolving. That was a very emotional show to listen to, and obviously for you and Chris, I'm sure it was emotional to go through. Do you sense that your final show will carry similar emotions in terms of, listen, I don't expect you to break down on the air, but will that show, you think, the last 15 minutes be hard to get through, or will it not be the same?
I think the whole show will be very emotional. I think a lot of the last couple of shows are going to be emotional, every part of it. I think next Sunday's show, we're doing a special football show, and I've done the football show for 30 years until this year. I've received tremendous interest. As a matter of fact, we sold 500 tickets in less than a couple of hours just for the breakfast that I'm going to do the football show around, and we sold it out in about an hour and a half. I'm doing one this Sunday. I think that will be emotional. I think all these last steps, I think all next week will be very emotional. And I'm sure the last show will be exceedingly emotional. I don't know exactly what it's going to be like. It's not going to be in any way scripted. It's not going to be in any way, and it won't have any form to it at all, except myself and the callers. It's not the day before is going to be the goodbyes from whoever wants to call that's in the business, or friends or coaches, whoever it may be. It could be governors, could be who knows. I don't even know who's going to call, but whoever calls, that'll be the Thursday show. That's what that's for. That's in a public place. I'm going to do media that day. I'm going to do interviews that day. The last day, I'm not doing anything. No interviews. No one's allowed to the studio. I'm not even letting my family come to the studio. I'm making them go the day before because I want the last show to be as much like it is, as always has been, and I don't want anybody around except the callers and myself so that I can do the show the way I normally do it. And that's how I wanted to do the last one.
Mike, have you found that, are the traits to being a great sports talk host in New York City the same traits you would need nationally? And if they are, what are they? And if they are different, what do you think is different about New York versus somebody who does a national sports show?
I think New York's completely different. First of all, New York never, or I should say very rarely, gets behind one thing. It's too big, it's too diverse, it's too cosmopolitan. I think that's why the NFL, as an example, hated New York for the Super Bowl, because they never felt like they took over the city, because you can't take over New York. It's too hard. It's always got some other interest. And that's how our fans are. They're always on to the next team. They're always on to the next event. What happens is, when you're bad, they move on from you. Now, there are exceptions, like right now the Giants are a bit of a passion play because of Eli. But for the most part, what happens in this town is they just move on to the next team, to the next season. We have 9 professional teams. We have multifaceted. We have a million different interests. We have everything in the world here. You know, so from that standpoint, New York is far more diverse and far harder to really have that big an impact in. And that's what I'm most proud of, is that I've always been able to have a pretty big impact in the city, which has been, you know, my gift. It really is. It's been the one thing that the city's given me, is that they've always been interested in what I've had to say. They've always tuned into what I had to say, and I think that's where I've had a special relationship.
Mike, why do you think people still call into sports talk shows in 2017?
I think sports talk works because it is personal. It's still a very pure forum. Even in this time where you can have social networks and you can have the internet, you can have Twitter, and you can have all these different ways of relating to people. First of all, there's also a fake aspect to all of that. You never know for sure who you're talking to. There's also a very, I know the word fake news has been thrown around too much and too liberally lately, but the problem is there is a portion of the internet, and I believe that part of it has to be cleaned up by the government. There is too much fake stuff going on the internet because it's faceless, it's nameless, and you can hide behind just a nickname or a surname or something else, and you don't really know who it is. Sports radio is different, though, because the person has to get on there. Now, they can give a fake name, but it's still their voice, it's still them, and for the most part, it's a person who wants to be heard, that wants to make a point, and wants to get involved in the action, that wants to join the show, and to me, that very pure personal nature, that is why sports talk still works, and I think will work for a long time.
Mike, is there anyone nationally, whether Dan Patrick, Colin Cowherd, Jim Rome, the Greenberg and Golic show, who did a national sports talk show that you particularly liked?
Never been a fan of the national sports talk shows for a lot of different reasons. Plus, I don't get to hear very many of them. I mean, my day is pretty consumed. I mean, I'm on the air longer than anybody else. If you add in travel, that's another 4 hours a day. Add in, phone calls and preparation. I don't really get a chance to hear anybody else. But I think the very nature of the national show does not allow it to have the command, the presence, or the impact that a local show has. And that's why I always preferred the local show. We could have gone national a million times. Mike and the Mad Dog was offered to go national forever, but we never wanted to lose the impact of what we had in this city. Plus, in this city, if you're big, the economics work very fine for you, so you don't have to go chasing national dollars, which you do in other cities. So from that standpoint, being New York-centric was always enough, especially for me. It's all I ever aspired to was to have a commanding presence in this town. I never aspired to more than that.
One of the things, Mike, that's really interesting to me about New York and Boston, I've listened to sports talk around the country, but New York and Boston, this is really, really true, is just often how provincial the callers are. You could, as you know better than anyone, you could have done weeks and weeks and weeks just on the Yankees, and you would have never run out of calls. You would have never run out of dialogue. Throughout your career at The Fan, were sports callers always provincial and always sort of New York-centric, or was there a moment when things turned, and maybe things turned when some of the New York teams got good for you in the 90s, like the Knicks, the Yankees, etc.?
No, sports talk is always, at its best, sports talk is very, very small town, very neighborhood. You know, the depiction of the old neighborhood bar, what it used to be in the 40s and 50s, how the guy would stop at the tavern on the way home or the local bar at the way home and have his one drink before he'd go home, and he'd talk to his buddies about sports or politics or whatever the thing might be, or go down and watch the Friday night fights. You know, what we replaced that bar as the mores changed, as drinking changed, as the feelings against certain kinds of inebriation, like the Mothers Against Drunk Driving, completely changed America, which they did. That bar went away, but that whole essence of that has been wrapped up in what we do. You know, we have been depicted many times as that neighborhood bar where you can still go talk sports, and I think it's true. But the difference is now the way we're connected. If I say something national in nature, or even about a team of ours that's very big, like the Yankees or the Giants, it flies around the country in a matter of minutes. When I did the rant on the Giants and Eli's benching the other day, that thing was the number two, according to my producers, the number two prominent running story in America. behind North Korea for like an hour and a half. I mean, it had been picked up everywhere in the country by Giant fans all over the country, by football fans all over the country. So from New York, I think especially, you can have that kind of impact. And I always think the guy who's tops in New York has a special place nationally anyway, because everyone acts like they don't pay attention to New York and they don't care about New York. But you know what? Everybody does pay attention to New York. All the decision makers on every level are in New York or have something to do with New York. So New York is still not just the number one city. It's a city that almost is a nation unto itself.
Mike, you sort of hit on this, but I want to sort of explore it a little bit. Especially the last like 10 or 15 years, there would be things that you would say on the air or rants that you might have, and they would go viral. Whether you would be going off on Rex and the Jets, and correctly so, by the way. Obviously, you mentioned Eli. You know, there have been times where you've gone off on management where this just did not stay contained in New York, or even on even with like social media people who are New York centric. For whatever reason, you are, maybe lightning rod is not the right word, but you became a person of interest nationally for sports talk fans, for sports blogs. And I wonder if you had any sense as to why that is. Was it just New York? Was it something unique to you? Was it your longevity? Was it a combination, let's say, of all those things?
I don't have the answer to this one. And this one has been the biggest surprise of my career. And that is that sometime, once the social media became very much a part of the daily ritual and the daily vibe and the daily voice of sports, for some reason, everything I said became very important. There are certain people who people realized all those pieces on the internet, all those websites are in the business, as we all know, of getting page hits and getting people to view their pages. Well, for some reason, I don't know what it is, and this is the one I don't have an answer to, I became a guy who drew tremendous amount of eyeballs to every page I was on. So all of a sudden, it wasn't just the local newspapers that had their websites. It was all those national sports websites. It was all different websites. And I got told this by a bunch of people. I always said, why are you so fascinated? I've even asked them, why are you so fascinated with everything I say? And they said, we can put you up there and you will always draw enormous attention. There's just certain people that do. I don't know what caused that. I really don't. So I don't have the scientific answer or an answer why it happened, but I did notice that it happened, and I even responded to it in certain ways because I started having this following called Mongo Nation, which right. I even named one of my racehorses after. They have been very pronounced. They're at everything I do. They're at every event. These kids, and they're young. They're young 20s. They're at every event I go to. They're at Francesicon. Francesicon is an outshoot of that. Everybody at Francesicon, for the most part, is under 40 years old. It's amazing. You got 1,000 people dressing up like you, and they're all under 40 years old. It's crazy. And it's all an offshoot of what you just addressed. I don't know what caused that. That's been, I would say, the biggest surprise. And in a lot of ways, it's really, I think, made these last years a lot more interesting and a lot more viable, because a lot of times when you grow old with your audience grows old with you. For some reason, I have connected with the younger audience tremendously well, which has helped me a lot in terms of my ability to command the audience and not lose the younger part of the audience. So that has been remarkable, and I don't know what has caused it. I really don't.
Yeah, that's interesting, and it has given you a sense of relevancy, and it's always, that's kind of always been fascinating to me, especially as somebody who covers media. At what point, Mike, if ever, will you listen to the new trio that will work the afternoon shift on The Fan?
Oh, I'm sure I'll be in the car, and that's when I really listen to sports talk, and I like to drive sometimes. I mean, I have Julio driving me every day, but I like to jump in the car and drive when I get a chance, and that's when I'll throw it on, and I'll be driving along some highway and driving somewhere to pick up one of my kids. And you know, that's one of my big jobs now, is, you know, picking up my kids everywhere and taking them to practice and taking them here and taking them there, which is, you know, now they're teenagers or just about. And I have two going to be 13 and one just turned 11. So you wind up being a chauffeur a lot. So I'll be in the car and I'm sure I will hear them. I would not turn them off. I would definitely listen to them. So I'll be interested in what they do. You know, they're creating a very different show. I know what the mind is of the person who is going to lead them, and that's Mark Chernoff. I know what he thinks. I understand how he attacks ratings. I've worked with him for all these years. Now, this is a three-man show, and it's also a very diverse show with an African-American host and a female host. So it's going to be a very different show. How it's going to work, what the dynamics are, I'm sure they're not even sure yet. But I will, I'm sure, turn it on and be interested in what the result is.
Mike, do you have any thoughts on the philosophy of a three-person sports talk show versus what we usually get, a two-person or a solo soloist? We have seen, obviously, some shows that have three people, but that's still, generally speaking, a rarity versus a two-person show or a one-person show.
Well, it's interesting. I've always found it interesting that nobody who analyzes what we do has spent any time on the fact that the two people who created the multi-person show in America have worked alone for the last decade, and
right.
That's Mike and the Mad Dog. We created the two-man show. When we started, it was all one guy, mostly after the 6 o'clock or after drive time, who would be working and would be doing sports talk at night. We changed that whole genre across the country. Mike and the Mad Dog completely changed that. And we made it where everybody wanted teams. And then the teams even grew, sometimes the 3 and 4 people, as we know. I've always thought more than two would be difficult, depending on what the dynamics of. What made Mike and the Mad Dog so different was that it was two people who never stopped working individually ever. We each worked shows our whole lives by ourselves. Always thought we could work alone, but also had the most superb chemistry when we worked together. It was two very strong individual performers, very talented individual performers, who could work very well together alone or very well together together. And ironically, we worked apart each for the last 10 years, which is, I always thought, felt quite an irony.
It's true. And I think probably continued longer than I think, imagine a lot of people thought each of you would have continued as soloists. Mike, I don't expect you to answer this, but I'm going to ask it anyway. I work with a guy, Jimmy Traina, who I would consider a foremost Francesa-ologist. And
right, I know Jimmy.
Okay, he swears that this is what you are going to do post-WFAN. A podcast with Bill Simmons on The Ringer, a weekly television show on Madison Square Garden on MSG, and 2 to 3 hours a week with Chris Russo on Sirius XM. If I went to Vegas with this, Mike, how should I be feeling?
Well, if you're going to bet the trifecta, I think it's a long shot, okay? I really do. I think it's a real long shot. I would consider the TV part probably a non-starter. I would consider the Mad Dog part a very, very unlikely pairing for a lot of reasons, including economics. And as far as Bill, it's no secret that Bill and I like to work together. He's already, you know, a lot of people want to know where I'll go to finish my football picks, which are very popular, and people have asked me, so a couple people have asked me to sell them. I said no. But I will pick, and Bill has offered me a home to pick him on his podcast, which I'm thinking about. The NFL Network has offered me the Good Morning Football show because I've invited Schrager on my show this year, and they've invited me on that show to do it. So I've been offered 3 or 4 different places just to do my football picks for the rest of the year, which I will do somewhere. I don't know where. I would say the likeliest place is probably Simmons' podcast because of my relationship with him. I don't know that we'll ever work together in any real fashion. But I would say a couple of those have very slim chances. But if you were going to bet the trifecta, that's going to be a hard one to have come home.
I'm not betting the trifecta on that one. Just one quick thing on Simmons. Does that appeal to you? Because one, obviously you like working with Bill, and two, it keeps you connected to what would be a very youthful audience?
I love working with Simmons. I love how his mind works. I think as far as someone who just gets sports and culture and is able to enunciate it and able to be provocative but also poignant, to me, I think he's the best there is out there. I don't think they've found the right vehicle for him on television yet. I think that's partially because he should be the two-man. He shouldn't be the point guard
right
on his telecasts, and I've tried to tell him that. But he'll find that. But he is probably got – I like people who have a good take on things. He's got a great take on things. I think he's a unique talent. I really do.
All right, a couple more areas here. You, historically, Mike, have not had a good relationship with ESPN. One, you obviously compete against them in New York, but you have always been honest about when you feel that that network has just gone wayward or the wrong way or just doing something that's too hubristic, et cetera. But you did decide to do the 30 for 30, which obviously is their product. Why, in the end, given your long relationship and the fact that, like, quite frankly, they compete against you, why did you decide to cooperate and ultimately do a 30 for 30?
Very good question. Number one, I had such a poor relationship with them that I actually did not do the 25th anniversary retrospective of FAN for Bill for his website. And he went crazy on me, called me 100 times, and said, "You're killing it. I even have Imus. I have Dog. I have everybody." And I still wouldn't do it, and I never did it. And he said I ruined it for him, and I still never did it. But I did this, and he's killed me for doing this when I didn't do that. And the reason why was twofold. Number one, really threefold. Number one, Dog asked me to do it. He really wanted me to do it. Number two, my kids asked me to do it, and that meant a lot to me. They really wanted to me to chronicle this thing and have something they could have as a history. My kids really pushed me to do it. And number three, the two guys who were doing it were guys I broke into the business with. Ted Shaker was my immediate boss on the NFL Today. Danny Fora and I did the studio show together. He was the producer of the college football show when I was the talent on the show with both Nance and then Pat O'Brien, one year Andrea Joyce. I was the analyst every year. They were the hosts. I had three different hosts, and he was the producer. So I had a comfort level with those guys. Those are the three reasons why I did it. My kids, Dog, and then the fact that it was Flora and Shaker who were going to do it.
Mike, one of the things that has always been fascinating to me about sports talk radio are successful rants, because they have to have a basis, I think, in belief, or you know, there has to be some kind of honesty in the rant, but there's also a lot of entertainment elements to it. Let's face it, you're on the air, you're entertaining people, you get into a little bit of a lather, and you go. As someone who has been very, very famous for, you know, under this framework of sports talk rants, how does one successfully do what you did regarding Eli Manning the other day?
First of all, you're 100% right. The rant can't be a fake. If you try to – now, listen, there are times we make something out of nothing. There are times things are tongue-in-cheek. But the best rants, the ones that really are the special ones, are based in real feelings. If they aren't, they don't work. So from that standpoint, but when you have a topic like that and you get going on a rant, the ability to understand what makes it theatrical is what separates the good host from the really good host. And I think you have to understand how to utilize what you utilize to do that. It really, there's just an art to it. And if you've been doing it as long as I have, you understand what that is.
Mike, has your preparation over the last couple of years changed for the show versus how you prepared when you and Dog did it? And you can go as deep as you want on this, but I'd just be curious as to how you prepare for the show, if there are specific preparations, or is it at this point now you just read as much as you can, you watch as much as you can, and because you've been on the air for as long as you have sort of a feel for what people want to talk about?
My preparation really hasn't changed that much from the early days to now. Now, we have to understand now that the average listener, the audience, has a lot more regular information at their fingertips. You don't have to now give them information that we would have had as media members that they didn't have 25 years ago. They have it now. So you have to understand that. But as far as it, the two facets that I've always utilized to do the show are, one, I watch the games, and I enjoy watching the games. And if you don't do that, I think it's hard to do what we do. And number two, I will pick up the phone and call whoever I need to call. So if I need a clarification, and those people have grown to trust me, I have people I'll talk to if I need to get to something. Or I may call an owner, I may call a manager, I may call a, you know, I don't call the players very often, but the players, that's a different story for the most part anyway. But as far as a manager, a general manager, an owner, I'll pick up the phone and call someone if I think I need to call them. I'll use that as background and say, listen, and they'll say this is off the record, but it gives me the background that I need to do that. That's always what I've always done. My opinions of mine, I don't think it would be fun to utilize somebody else's opinions or to be someone who says, oh, I'm going to, you know, I like this opinion. No, they're all mine. I mean, that's what makes it fun. I'm really someone who doesn't care a whole lot about other people's opinions. Now, maybe that's a shortcoming, but I really don't. I mean, I'm more interested in mine. So that's just the way I've always been. So that's always how I've played it.
Mike, as you look at the many interviews that you've conducted over the years, you've basically interviewed certainly every major figure in New York City sports over the last four decades, and most of the national ones as well. I actually read an interesting, I think it was the Barrett Sports Media, who had a long-form sit-down with you where you'd said...
Right, just recently, yeah.
Yeah, maybe the only person historically that you wish you had gotten that you couldn't was Joe DiMaggio, which was really...
That's the guy we always wanted, yeah. Both Doug and myself, and we tried very hard. Hank Goldberg, who did Sports Talk down in Florida forever, and was a guy that I knew from the days of Jimmy the Greek when we both worked for him. So Hank was very close with Joe. Joe trusted Hank. Still wouldn't do it. We actually did an interview with Ted Williams, and he said he would call Joe and say he could go on with us and trust us. We still couldn't get him on. We had Hank Bauer. We had Mouscarin. And now, Mickey, you weren't going to go to the ass joke because they didn't really love each other. But the point is, we tried every way. We just couldn't get him to trust us. He was not a very trusting guy. Wasn't a very good guy, to be honest with you.
Yep.
But we tried to get him. We thought he would be fascinating. We both liked the idea of that interview, but we never got it. There's a couple of others. I mean, you know, you want the Muhammad Ali. It would have been a great interview, you know, where he could really talk. Or Dog recently got Jack Nicklaus. I was a little jealous of that. I've never had a real long sit-down with him.
Wow.
I know Dog got him recently. I mean, that was a good one. So anybody like that who you really just haven't had a chance to really sit down and really delve into their career would be fascinating, of the iconic figures.
Yeah, by the way, I remember Mouscarin being on your show. I love that guy. Such a great...
Oh, I
great...
love Moose and Hank. We're great together. They were the best.
Great. Mike, I love the opportunity that I can do this. You may know this already, but literally... So I want to be the person to inform you of this. Literally, in the last 5 minutes, Ben McAdoo has been fired by the Giants, according to
NFL. I knew that. Yeah. I honestly have been waiting for it all morning. Ben, I told my guys to be ready for Ben to be gone before the show started. So I was just expecting it. If you listened to his press conference yesterday and read between the lines, he didn't even name a starting quarterback for this week, if you remember.
Yep.
Yesterday. And he even said, I haven't talked to anybody. I'm going to see if my card still works. What guy wouldn't go under those rumors and go talk to the owner? So he knew what was coming.
All right, a couple more topics here, and then I'll let you go. Is, you know, one of the you mentioned interviews before, and like I said, the show has interviewed, you interviewed along with Chris every major figure in New York sports. You've certainly gone. You've done national guys, both solo
right.
and with the Dog Show. What is interesting to me, Mike, is that are there any interviews that you regret when you found out later that the person you interviewed was lying to you? And specifically, and I think you have a good relationship with him, but I do want to ask you about Alex Rodriguez. Famously, came into your studio
sure.
and flat out lied.
Right.
He has, you know, to his credit, tried to sort of do a lot of mea culpa and reshaping his image. But If you watch that tape today, it's an outright lie to you. And I wonder, knowing you were going to be on with me, I wanted to just get your reflections as to that particular interview when you know someone lied to your face.
Listen, if you go back and look at that interview, I asked him the question 10 different ways, and I asked it every way I could. I told him this was going to be following him forever. I knew there was a very good chance he was lying, but to me, that was up to him. That was not my call. That was his call, and he chose to lie. I understood that. A lot of times when people are in the middle of that stuff, they lie. We all know that. That's part of the deal. But I also felt that baseball was being very unfair to him because they singled him out because that was how they were going to cleanse themselves, they felt, because I didn't feel he was any worse than anybody else who had done steroids.
Mike, is there a single show that you are most proud of, whether it was the specific content of the show or the show happened after something momentous like 9/11, et cetera?
Well, I felt the show that I did the day of 9/11. Now, days later, the stuff with Dog and I seemed to take on a life of its own, and it's been proved years later that it wasn't true. It was completely fabricated, which I always knew it was. That's why I never lost any sleep over it. But I felt that day, the show I did by myself, and then later on with Charles McCord, I thought was a great show. And all I did was follow the news where it took me. I had no idea where it was going to take me. And I got letters from sports newscasters and people in the business who told me it was one of the great jobs, and I kept some of those. And I had people tell me that. I was very proud of that show. I thought a lot of times, I thought the Hurricane shows, we did some really good shows. I thought the idea that I got the mayor's office to back off the marathon, and that was my voice that did that. I really felt they were going down the wrong road. I wasn't doing that to be sensational. I was doing it because I believed it. I thought the marathon was a mistake at that time, and they backed off. I thought those were great shows.
All right, a couple more here. Mike, did you famously have been the subject of a lot of writers in New York who cover sports media. I shouldn't say a lot, but specifically Phil Mushnick, Bob Raceman are guys who covered sports media throughout their careers. You were the central part of their columns for decades. Neil Best on in Long Island, but he's kind of got a little bit of a different POV than those guys. How did you look specifically with Mushnick, who still to this day will write about you on a daily basis? How did you look at the daily criticism that you took in some of the New York tabloids?
I've got to tell you, as far as a lot of it, I stopped reading it a long time ago. I stopped paying attention to it because it was so one-sided. And a lot of it was them not even listening to the show, but taking it off guys who were reporting stuff off the internet, which might not even have been accurate. And a lot of times it wasn't accurate. And there were so many times it was inaccurate, it was a farce, and we'd laugh about it because it was farcical. But I could tell you this, and this is the only thing I can say about it. You know what? When you're in a very prominent position, people are going to attack you. You have to understand that. Number two, I never once walked into a meeting with a sponsor, with somebody who was trying to hire me, or to do something or anything else where somebody once brought up anything from any of those columns. Not one time in my entire career. I have been handsomely paid. I have won every award that anybody can win more times than anybody else by a mile. I have completely dominated. So to me, that is the fair part, and some of the other stuff you got to take with the job. That's, you know, the fact that Radio Links picked me every year they've ever voted. The fact that Talkers has picked me first every year they've ever had a poll, every single time, both polls nationally, I'm the only person to ever finished first. To me, that's fair and objective, and that's how I look at it, and you take the good with the bad.
Michael, one of the last subjects I want to get to you is about politics. I read the Neil Best piece that he did on you a couple years ago, and he went to your house. I think he drove with you into the city. It was really interesting. You're not someone who often lets people into their private lives, talks about their kids, shows a reporter your personal life at your house. And there was a part in there where Neil writes that you have an entire cabinet filled with books on John Kennedy. And John Kennedy is obviously somebody who fascinates you. Maybe it's a personal hero, or if nothing else, it's just an era of history that's really, really interesting. And that's my prelude, Mike, into politics and a sports talk person discussing politics. So a couple questions on this. Philosophically, where do you stand on a front-facing person like yourself talking about politics or social issues?
It's a tricky thing. First of all, I only had two idols, JFK and Mickey Mantle. That's it. And I am a JFK nut. He was a hero of mine. I've tried to collect every book that I've ever been able to find. People send them to me. Book dealers send them to me. I collect them. I have hundreds of them. I've read every one of them, some of them more than once. But the talk show host who talks politics has to understand, especially in this day and age, you're going to alienate half your audience. That's all there is to it, okay? They're split down the middle, and the twain will never meet. So understand, if you're pro-Trump, half the people are going to hate it. When I said that I was backing Trump, I was not doing it as a right-wing ideologue, which I'm not. I'm an independent. I was saying I thought this guy could bring a unique view. That was my point. And I got more mail from people who said they would never listen to me again than I ever received in my entire life. So it just shows you, I had people say, I love you. I've listened to you every day. I'm never listening to you again. And so it shows you that you're going to alienate a lot of your audience. So for the average sports talk show host, I think it's the best to stay very neutral and keep your politics to yourself.
Did you largely avoided discussing Trump on the air throughout the campaign after speaking with Mark Chernoff, basically the VP of your programming. Was there a point where after he won his election that you decided that you might be more proactive about your feelings about Trump and or your feelings about the historic nature of that victory?
No, I mean, listen, I actually talked about Trump more when he was running for president than I have since he's been president. Because what happens is that Trump is, I've never seen anything like it. The people are supportive or they detest him. There's no middle ground. So the people of both sides are going to be so out there and so entrenched in their beliefs that, to me, you can't convince anybody of anything. So why even bother? There's no middle ground. There's not even any debate anymore. And that's the worst part of politics in America now, is I have to beat you and drive you into the ground. I have to convert you. I can't say that we can disagree and go about our business and both be good guys. It's that you're a bad guy if you believe that, and I'm a bad guy if I believe this. And unfortunately, that's where we are in this country, and that's a dangerous place.
One last one for me on this. You know, I live in New York, and I will be totally transparent with you. I think Donald Trump is awful for this country. That said,
all right, listen, I understand, and I think that's a very reasonable point of view.
Right. So what's interesting to me, Mike, and I want to get your take on this, because I think, in a way, I kind of admire you doing this in New York, because to me, talking about Donald Trump in New York with any kind of positive spin as you might have, or even let's just say you have a neutral take on Donald Trump in the New York City market, to me means that you're alienating more of your listeners than not, just given the demographics of the electorate. Did that ever factor in your mind, knowing that if you, let's say you're talking about Trump and you're hosting a talk show in Atlanta or in, you know, Texas, wherever, like, it's going to be far different than in New York City, where Democrats are winning this city, you know, 70-30 every time?
I think it's quite ironic, number one, because this is his city. I mean, so that's ironic that that's true, but it is true.
Right.
So he is incredibly unpopular in his own city, which is very true. I knew that it was going to be more negative than positive because I think, listen, Trump's got about 35% people who love him, and he's got about 50% who detest him, and he's got some that are in between. But the point is, it's very large of the people who don't like him and strongly opinionated in that way. I have been very honest about my thought process on him. I also have been honest since he was president with some things I'd rather see him not do. So I haven't said everything he's done has been positive since he's been president. I haven't treated it that way. I've tried to be fair. Where I thought it was outrageous, I said it. When I thought it was unfair, the criticism of him, I've said that. But more than anything else, I've tried to stay away from it more than anything else since he became president, because I didn't want it to overrun the show. And what I've noticed about the Trump stuff is it just overruns everything.
All right. Okay. Final couple for me. You,
yes.
In one of these in the Barrett interview again, which was really well done, I thought, by both of you guys, you talked about for you over the years who you thought were guests that really stood out. George Young, the late George
right.
Young, was an incredible guest in the early
right.
days for you. David Stern always gave it back to you and Chris, which was great radio. In the more sort of current realm, Mike, the last like 10, 15 years, What guests for you have stood out and why?
You know, I mentioned Stern and George Young because they were so curmudgeonly and they brought a great personality to the show without any question. In recent years, if I was going to give you someone that has really stood out as a guest in recent years, who would it be? You know, it just shows you no one, you know, most of the guys I'm thinking of come earlier in my time. So, who?
Would it be one of the managers that you've sort of gone back with, Girardi or Terry?
I think some of them were pretty good. I always thought Terry Collins was very honest, which I appreciated. I always thought Girardi was guarded. I think Cashman is very open. I'll give you credit for him. He'll stay an hour. He'll answer everything. And you're getting a real Cashman there. You're getting the same guy you would if you weren't on the air, which I think is admirable. So I would say him. I think he's very good. I don't think he's trying to be manipulative. I don't think he's trying to give you a message. I think he's being very honest.
Mike, is there anyone in these last 11 days, I mean, really big figures, whether it would be Tiger or Trump, A-Rod, Jeter, that you either have requested to talk to or that you think you're producers may get you as you know, as a real big kind of marquee interview as you head out over these last 2 weeks?
The guy we have tried to get, I gave them a list of the guys I wanted. There were 14 guys on the list.
Oh, wow.
We have not had any no's yet, but the guy that I want that I haven't got a yes from yet is Riley, because he was so much a part of the show.
Yeah, Pat Riley, right?
Pat Riley,
yep.
I have mentioned that he was so much a part of the early shows. He was a dominant figure. He was a dominant figure in New York, and he held a grudge with us ever since the time he left the Garden. And he explained why, because he felt that Dog and I owed him, that he was very good to us, and he was great to us. But I'd love to have him on one more time. And he hasn't said no yet, but he hasn't said yes yet.
Yeah, that's interesting. Has the show, Mike, ever interviewed LeBron James?
Had LeBron on once, but just for a very small, short time. Had Jordan on once.
Oh, wow.
I was once on Jordan's show when he did a show back in Chicago, back when I was doing the NCAA tournament. So we're 1-1, but he was only on for a very short time. Tiger Woods was on for a very short time. I met him once with Joe LaCava, who I know pretty well. But I've never done a real interview of any scope with any of those people.
And is there, so here are my two last ones. I know you're such a you love history. You mentioned, obviously, your passion for JFK.
Yes.
Is there anyone currently in politics that, and again, this might not happen, whether you had the option to do it in the last 2 weeks of the fan show, or maybe down the road if you did some kind of interview show, is there anyone in modern politics right now that you'd love to get an hour with?
I would love to interview Trump right now. I really would. I'd like to sit down and sit with him. And I don't know how open he'd be, but I'd love to talk to him. If I could go back in history, I'd love to talk to Harry Truman. And I would love to sit down with JFK. I mean, obviously, you know, the presidents that I would want to sit down with would be JFK, and Harry Truman would be 1-2.
Mm.
Absolutely. Truman stuff is life and the path. And the stuff that was thrust in his way is the most unbelievable converging of history and a man in the history of our country.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. I'd love to sit and talk with him.
Yeah, I'm really fascinated by LBJ, but I think Truman would be right up there as well.
You know, LBJ is very underrated because everyone gets into the Vietnam stuff, but he took the fact that there was such warmth towards the Kennedy and towards the Democrats because of the Kennedy assassination, and his complete control of Congress,
yep,
and his dominance there, and passed more legislation in 2 years than the next 10 presidents combined.
Correct.
So he is probably the most important president who gets no attention in history.
I would agree with you on that. I read that you, at least for the first couple of months of this deal, you can't do local radio, network radio, satellite radio, podcast. 3 months, right? You can do television. So I want to ask you as we sort of head out here is, how will you adjust to 3 months of not getting your voice out, of not being able to go to a place on a daily basis to offer your opinions about sports and other things?
I think I'll be going door to door. I'm probably going to have a door to door tour, and until they start not opening the door for me when there's a big event, I'll just go door to door. That's it. Or maybe I'll grab Julio and we'll have to ride town to town. But or I'll set a platform up near a supermarket. I'll come up with a couple of ways.
How about the train tour, Mike? Like Truman
maybe,
did.
Maybe we'll go over to the LIRE train station in the morning, and I can do 15 minutes there. As a matter of fact, might head there right now and do a couple of minutes on the Giants before I head into the studio.
I love it. Francesa at Jamaica Station. I'll come by and watch that. Mike Francesa for four decades has been the dominant sports talk voice in New York City. He is one half of arguably the most famous sports talk show in history, the Mike and the Mad Dog Show. He leaves his afternoon show on WFAN in New York on December 15th, he is one of the iconic figures for sure in the city that I live in. Mike, I know you have not done a ton of podcasts where you've gone, this long. So I really appreciate you coming on, and thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it.
All right, back in the studio, my thanks to Mike Francesa for his time. He doesn't do a lot of those. He's certainly going to do some media, obviously, in the last couple of days of his tenure at WFAN. But he's somebody I've wanted to do for a while, and I really enjoyed that. I think he got the full Francesa experience, which was great. Previous podcasts include a sports media roundtable with Chad Finn and John Orand and Omar Raja, who is the House of Highlights founder, Tara Lipinski and Johnny Weir before that, Gino Auriemma, the coach of the University of Connecticut women's basketball team, who also has a very popular podcast, and Marty Smith of ESPN. Lou Pellegrino is my producer, as always, and I appreciate him working on this episode. Did some nice producing on this one. Thanks to Cadence 13. Thanks to Sports Illustrated. We'll see you next time on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.